you are about to see the first public exhibition of an entirely new form of entertainment.
That belongs in a museum.
You are about to see the first public exhibition of an entirely new form of entertainment.
That belongs in a museum.
Welcome to another exciting episode of Treasury Cast, the show that celebrates the greatest comics format of all time, the Treasury Edition. Proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly. And joining us this episode is our pal from the King Size Comics Giant Size Fun podcast, Kyle Benning. Hello, Kyle.
Hey, thanks for having me aboard.
I'm very happy to have you here. I know that, of course, from your podcast, you are a big fan, no pun intended, of the Treasuries. you're a fan of comics of giant proportions, in whether it be page count or, you know, dimensions, however it's big, you're a fan of it. So in case anyone is here listening to this is not familiar with your show, why don't you describe it a little bit?
Oh, I have a number of shows on the feed, and they're all kind of on a temporary hiatus right now. The show launched talking specifically about pages with or books with extra page counts, so things like Treasuries or the 80-page Giants, the 100-page Super Spectaculars, or the Marvel King-sized Annuals or Giant-sized Specials. And I guess kind of my affection or affinity for that type of style just stems from that a lot of, like, dollar comics, especially the dollar comics era of World's Finest, really some of the first things I ever read, along with I have a big love for the Fantastic Four because I inherited a huge Fantastic Four collection as well. So anytime you talk about, I guess, spoilers, you haven't said what we're covering this time, have you?
Yeah, it's the perfect segue.
Anytime those cross and I can talk about Fantastic Four in a giant size format, I get pretty excited about it. But the reading Fantastic Four, and then I really just kind of fell in love with the anthology story format and books with extra page counts due to the Dollar Comics era of DC Comics, specifically those great World's Finest issues that Ryan has been covering a number of the Black Canary stories from lately.
Very cool. Well said. As Kyle talks about, we are going to be talking about a Fantastic Four comic, namely Marvel Treasury Edition number 2, The Fabulous Fantastic Four, which came out on September 17th of 1974. Now, before we get to this book specifically, I do want to give a little bit of a history of the Marvel Treasury Edition as a series, because this is actually the first Marvel Treasury Edition that we're getting to on the show. Marvel Treasury Edition was basically Marvel's version of DC's Limited Collector's Edition, and that it was their main title when they were doing Treasuries. And they did other series, they did spin-offs and one-shots here and there, but Marvel Treasury was the main series. It started in 1974, it ran all the way until 1981, where they ended it with issue number 28, which was the second Superman-Spider-Man team-up. This was really Marvel's big deal, and unlike DC, which tended to kind of go all over the place with its character choices, Marvel really kept it pretty pure. They tended to focus on their big stars, namely the first issue was Spider-Man, second was Fantastic Four, Thor, Hulk, Conan. They're really big marquee characters were the subjects of the Marvel Treasury Edition. So this is it. This is number 2, the Fantastic Four. Now, Kyle, did you have this one as a kid?
Yeah, this would have been the first Treasury I ever got. I got it probably when I was around 7 or 8 years old, which would have been like 94, 1995-ish. And I picked it up at a garage sale along with a Hulk Treasury. I believe it's Marvel Treasury Edition number 17. It has like the cover item has Hulk and there's like lightning bolts and stuff.
Right, raining on him. He's like raging to the heavens. Yeah.
Yep. So I picked both of these up at the same garage sale. This one's in pretty good shape. The Hulk one's in decent shape. It's just missing the back cover. But those were my first two Treasury Editions, and it made sense too because some of the comics, or most of the comics I inherited from my dad's youngest brothers were mid-70s to mid-80s near-complete runs of Fantastic Four and The Incredible Hulk. And there's a bunch of G.I. Joe and your favorite Transformers in there as well. So,
but, isn't that the good old days where you could get stuff like that at garage sales?
Yeah. Oh, man. That was kind of my thing in the 90s. That's where most of the, I guess, not really new comics, but new to me, was the way I picked them up. Because once Diamond took over, we didn't have a comic shop. The closest one's like 30 miles away. And even before that point, the grocery stores and stuff would sell comics, but most of those, growing up having read stuff from kind of classic Bronze Age era, and then getting my hands on things like Bring on the Bad Guys from my local library. I had much more of a kind of classic Marvel and DC house style aesthetic that I liked. And then, you know, you go to the grocery store and you see something like X-Force number 3 or something on the shelf. And that's not how the X-Men look.
So, yeah, right. Yeah.
That stuff didn't really appeal to me. So, yeah, anytime I could get my hands on something at a garage sale that was from the 70s or 80s that looked much more like the stuff I was used to. So that's naturally where I gravitated towards.
Well, speaking of house style, once again, you're sort of dropping a hint about what we're going to be talking about, because this cover, the cover for this book is by John Romita. And I don't know about you, but when I think of the Fantastic Four, for whatever reason, this is the image I think of. This shot of the four of them is about as iconic as it gets for Marvel Comics. You've got Reed, Sue, Johnny, and the Thing lunging at the camera. They're popping out of this frame in front of a white background cover. It is, you know, quite literally like the kind of art you would put on a t-shirt.
Yeah, I totally agree. I was actually sitting down thinking about that. I was like, God, my tongue cliched a little bit, and maybe it's because it hit me at such an early age, but I'm like, this is like the most iconic Fantastic Four image I can think of. And then I thought, well, you know, you got the covers like Fantastic Four number 1, you got the one where I think it's number 4 where they're in the Fantastic car kind of hovering over the city, you know, and Johnny's doing the circle in the flames. And then I got to think, well, you know, and then you got the 3 Galactus trilogy covers, but everything that was coming to mind was Kirby. This is definitely going to be the most, hands down, the most iconic non-Kirby Fantastic Four image, I think.
Yeah.
And then I would put it right up there with any of his as well. So I think it's definitely one of the top 5 most iconic Fantastic Four images or covers.
Yeah, I mean, you see everybody's powers. You know, Sue's half invisible, and they say Johnny's on fire, and of course the Thing is the Thing. You see Mr. Fantastic stretching, and you even get the Baxter Building in the background with the rocket taking off. I mean, it's just perfect. And, you know, it says on the cover, a deluxe limited edition of the world's greatest super team. You're like, well, yeah, that's all you need to know. I mean, what else do you need to do to spend $1.50, kids? I mean, this is it.
Yeah.
It's a really, really beautiful cover. So the inside cover features a editorial by Stan Lee, of course, and there's a great little doodle of him, maybe more than a doodle, I should say, a little drawing of him from the Thing transforming into Stan Lee, which I'm pretty sure is by Marie Severin, because that looks like her style. And it's great because, you know, it's typical sort of Stan Lee patois from the 70s. It's all full of alliteration and puns, talking about how great the Fantastic Four is. So, you know, it's Stan welcoming you to the Fantastic Four, which is a little strange because in the subsequent pages, we're going to get a lot of footnotes from Roy Thomas. He seems to be more the editor of this than Stan was. Of course, Stan was pretty much kind of the godfather of Marvel by 1974. But again, it's a nice way to sort of intro the book of, you know, Stan's here to remind us all about the early days of the Fantastic Four. And then the first page that you see outside of the inside cover is this table of contents. And it's, you know, I've mentioned this on previous episodes. It is this stuff that makes me love these treasuries, these little bonus things. This table of contents it's in the center. You've got the listings of the stories coming up, and it's framed by all of the classic Fantastic Four characters, again, drawn by John Romita. And this has got everybody, like the entire history of the Fantastic Four can be summed up on this page. I love this table of contents.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. Everybody.
Dr. Doom, Submariner, Galactus, The Watcher, Kree, the Inhumans, Black Panther. I mean, it's just, you know, the Puppet Master, the Sandman, the Impossible Man. It's just, it's so beautiful. And I love that it's monochromatic, except for the 4 close-ups of the Fantastic Four who are in color. It's such a, it's just for such a simple little thing to be a table of contents, it's such a beautiful image. Absolutely love it. And I said, it's this kind of stuff that makes me love these treasures. And I even love the little lead on at the beginning where it says, well, what are you waiting for, friend? A free ride of the Fantastic Four? Fantastic Four? Turn the page and let the wonderment begin. Like, I will, Stan. I can't wait to read all this. This is so exciting. So
Romita really does a great job of aping Kirby and some of the characters that definitely need more of a Kirby look to them. And then he has some great Kirby crackle in here too.
There is a lot of Kirby crackle. That's true.
Was Romita the art director at Marvel at this time, or would that come later?
I believe that he was. I believe at this point. I mean, he handled a lot of their covers, and he was certainly the merchandising guy. So, I mean, I guess it fell to him to do a lot of this stuff. And I bet this was probably a lot of fun to draw. I mean, a lot of work. but probably also a lot of fun just to draw all these crazy characters all intermingling and stuff. It's cool. So the first story that this book reprints, is from Fantastic Four, number 6 from 1962, Captives of the Deadly Duo. And it's, of course, by Stan Lee and Jack Kirby, and inks by Dick Ayers. And the plot is basically, while the Fantastic Four answers the piles of fan mail they receive every day, the nefarious Dr. Doom is busy launching a new scheme to defeat them, namely, teaming up with the Submariner. He finds Namor harmlessly swimming with some dolphins when he promises that if they join forces, they can destroy the FF and then all of mankind. Namor is reluctant to go along, but Doom plays to his vanity and talks about how the Atlantis suffered at the hands of the surface world, and then Namor finally relents. Namor arrives at the Baxter Building. As expected, the FF wants to tackle him. Getting in the way is Sue, whose feelings about the Submariner are mixed at best. Dr. Doom's plan is nothing less than launching the Baxter Building into outer space, and he uses Namor unwillingly to get that across by burying a magnet inside, and Namor is the one who accidentally launches it. Namor comes to its senses and helps the FF escape and thwart Doom's plan. After the Baxter Building is returned to its original location, Namor goes back to the sea. Obviously, there's a whole lot more to this story than just my sort of basic synopsis, but this is an extraordinarily fun story because it's just great seeing Dr. Doom and Namor teaming up. I mean, this is the first time they teamed up in the history of the Fantastic Four. This is a really fun story, and not only is it a great one to reprint because it features, you know, all two of the big villains at the time of the Fantastic Four, it's got some really great Kirby splash pages. What did you think of this story?
Yeah, no, it was really neat and important from a historical standpoint. It would have been just the second Silver Age appearance of Namor. He made his first Silver Age appearance in Fantastic Four number 4, so 2 issues before this, and it would have been just the second appearance ever of Dr. Doom, who appeared the issue before this. So, yeah, definitely huge. And then, of course, they would go on to have a supervillain team-up title together. So
that's right.
The genesis of that series here. And I didn't get a chance to go back and look through my masterwork, but the close to a half-page splash or two-thirds of page splash on page 6 there, I believe that's the first time we've ever seen a cutaway of the Baxter Building showing where everything is.
I love that. Yeah, and we'll get to that on the inside back cover, the whole thing about the Baxter Building. But yeah, this is a beautiful story, as of course Kirby's doing amazing work. I love the first shot we get of Namor's throne room where Dr. Doom is talking to him. I love all the design of that. Namor is sitting on this giant, like, conch shell throne, and he's got some jellyfish inside of a globe, and there's like starfish. Like, that is one, and the table is in the shape of a starfish. That is like one tricked out pad.
Yeah, that's very cool. Yeah, it's definitely got kind of the swinging 60s bachelor pad vibe on it, kind of imprinted under the sea there. It's pretty neat.
Yeah, and I love the way he's sitting. He's sitting back and his hands are folded, and he's very distrustful of Namor. And this story features a really great moment where Namor is basically browbeaten into it by Dr. Doom. This row of panels where Doom is just behind Namor, and he's literally like whispering in his ear, talking about revenge, and he basically just mind F's Namor into going along with him.
Yeah.
It's such a great character bit. Like, it's like Stan, and you could see why the Fantastic Four was such a sensation, because you didn't see stuff like that in DC Comics at the time. Stan Lee really was breaking new ground. It is one of the great, I think it's one of the great Fantastic Four moments to watch Namor, just such a bullheaded guy, succumb to Dr. Doom's mind games. I love it.
This one was never made into a power record, was it?
Unfortunately, no. It would have been.
This would have been so perfect. It was so melodramatic. I mean, I could just, the voice I was reading a lot of the dialogue in, as I was thinking back to the, there's that, I think it was the only power record of Captain America, and you and Chris have already covered it before, that was Steve Englehart one that Sal Buscema did the art on.
Right.
And the guy that was, that was a super melodramatic issue of Captain America, and he's just like going on, like, "Whoa, is me, man, I died." I could just hear that guy's voice doing some of the parts in here, because it was so melodramatic and such a soap opera here. It would have made a great power records.
That would have been really cool. Okay, so this story is extraordinarily fun. I love the whole angle that Sue has, you know, still harboring her crush on Namor. She's keeping a photo of him in her bookcase.
Yeah,
Namor
had one of her too. They must have gone and gotten like professional headshots done together and then exchanged photos, because they both have some pretty professional looking photos of each other there that they're pining over.
Yeah. And on top of the fact that you've got Doom and Namor teaming up, you've got the whole angle of the Baxter Building literally being launched into space. And so when you've got the splash page for Chapter 4, it's a great downshot of New York City from the sky. And so you're seeing all the land masses as the Baxter Building is literally just being thrown into outer space. It's just, it's, you know, a wonderful Fantastic Four moment. It's just so dramatic of you're looking out the window and all of a sudden you're seeing the entire New York, you know, New York City, the Manhattan Island below you. It's such a great visual. And I love that when on the bottom of that page, Reed is getting so upset and Namor's just like, the air is getting pretty mighty thin. We'll perish from lack of oxygen before we can take any action. He's just kind of calm about it. He's got his hand his chin.
He was calm throughout it. He comes into the Baxter Building, and Johnny's freaking out, wanting to fight with him, and he's sitting there super calm. It's, God, how often does that happen, that Namor's the calm voice of reason here? He's kind of that way throughout the issue.
And it features another great moment where later on in the story where Namor has to push himself outside in outer space, and there's these three successive panels where he's yelling, go, 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 and the camera's getting closer and closer to his face. That is, it's again, it's a great Kirby moment. It's the such a great sort of, you know, like action beat to as the camera zooms in on Namor's face.
Yeah, that is a good one. I think my favorite single panel in here is the last panel on page 13. The panel before that's great, too, where you see Namor flying at the fighter jet, and they think it's a missile, and then he veers off the end there.
Mm-hmm.
That panel must have been pretty influential to John Byrne, because when he was on his Namor run, that's kind of the pose he would always show Namor flying in, and he would use that pose a lot for Superman. I just saw that.
Oh, you're right.
That's where that pose comes from.
That's right.
That's totally a John Byrne character and flight pose. So
yeah, the arms in like a slight winged pose, kind of, and then the palms turned out. Yeah, you're right. It's a really it's interesting. Namor in red trunks. I don't think we've ever seen that again. I think he's always been green after this.
Yeah, there's a few coloring errors in here that. Well, I guess I don't know if this was a coloring error. I should have pulled out the essential and verified what color of trunks he was wearing in issue 4 when he first made his comeback. But on that page, and you mentioned it before, with the three-panel progression, with Doom's kind of browbeating Namor into siding with him, Doom's left hand there is flesh-colored in that one, the coloring error instead of being gray.
It's the, you know, sometimes comics are... A lot of things happen when you're trying to put together.
Yeah, well, normally that 9-panel grid on the normal size comic, you probably wouldn't even notice, but when it's blown up here, then obviously it kind of makes that coloring here stick out. I was going to say, can you turn to page 20 for me? And I'm just curious, mine has a little bit of like a printing error where the word bubbles didn't transfer all that well. And I'm curious if your copy has that as well. On the top right panel on page 20, some of Doom's dialogues dropped out there. I assume it says, capable of blocking my ambition to rule the entire world. Rule is missing from mine.
Yes, it is. Yeah, mine's gone. It's gone from mine as well.
Somebody must have been a pretty widespread printing error then.
Somebody bumped the machine at that point when they were running them off the printer.
Yep.
Again, you know, newsprint can be pretty unforgiving. Yeah, it's a really fun story, full of classic Fantastic Four moments. Some great characters, you know, two of the biggest characters of the FF family. So it's a perfect story to run in a Treasury edition. It tells you everything you need to know about these relationships early on. So it's really a whole lot of fun. It's a great, great story. So it's a super way to start the book. So the second story is from Fantastic Four number 11, The Impossible Man. And, of course, it's also by Lee and Kirby and Dick Ayers. So, Kyle, why don't you take it away?
Yeah, everybody's favorite, The Impossible Man. So we get The Impossible Man making his first appearance here and last appearance for a long time. There's an editor note in the book that he'll be coming back soon. And Len Wein must have been writing the book at this time. But so we see The Impossible Man land on Earth. He comes from the planet Pop-Up, where all characters there, are all beings there to survive the harsh environment, are blessed with the ability to change their body and transform into whatever they want. So he decides he's going to take a vacation, turn into a rocket, and come and visit Earth. So he lands amongst a camp of hobos, and they tell him about how they don't want any freeloaders. He wants to join up with their crowd. He needs to go get some money. So he just goes to the bank and robs it, you know, not knowing. And police try to blast him, and he turns into like a steel, and they just bullets bounce off him. So the police think this is all kind of a prank, and they're afraid of looking bad, so they call in the Fantastic Four, and course, Johnny and Ben both overreact right away and resort to violence, and it's ineffective against him. And after the Fantastic Four try everything they can think of, to no avail, they just cannot stop the wacky shape-shifting power of the Impossible Man. Reed decides that the only way to beat him is to just give up, and so he convinces the people of Earth to just ignore the Impossible Man. He's doing this all for entertainment, and once he gets bored because no one will pay any attention to him, he turns around and leaves Earth. That's kind of the end there.
It's a short story. It doesn't fill the whole book, but there's a second story, and we'll get to that in a moment. I actually really like this one because it is so much Stan Lee just borrowing some of his old 50s monster plots and just reappropriating it for a Fantastic Four story. Because there were so many stories that ended like this, where some giant monster like Gagoom or something, you know, attacks Earth, and then some scientist figures out a way to defeat it. And this is just Stan reusing one of those plots, except using it for the Fantastic Four, which I thought was, you know, pretty clever, because I think he didn't figure that, you know, he had the same audience for all these comics, so he figured nobody would notice that he's just borrowing from himself.
Yeah, it gave me kind of a 50s, early 50s sci-fi, like DC vibe, almost like something you'd read out of Strange Adventures.
Yes, yeah.
With kind of a Batmite influence, that's kind of what it reminded me of, but he's not as maniacal or benevolent as like Mixie would be, but kind of had more of the innocent cause trouble just looking for entertainment but not really meaning any harm aspect that Batmite brought with him.
Yeah, I mean, the whole idea is that he just wants attention, and then when he doesn't get any, then he just gives up. I love the idea that this whole story is finished up in one page. Like basically, yeah. The whole solution to it is in the 9 panels where Reed, I think something like a month transpires in 9 panels on the last page, yep. Where Reed comes up with the idea, the Impossible Man's like, hey, wait a minute, and then it goes on for like another month, and then he disappears. So it's just like, you know, let's wrap this up.
Have you read any of the subsequent appearances then of Impossible Man? They actually produced a big, like thick Impossible Man trade paperback not that long ago.
Really?
A few years ago. Yeah, it's one of their good thick ones that normally have like the $34.99 or $39.99 cover price. The one shop, local shop here, must have got a ton of them and didn't move them, because I don't know, a year or two ago I picked up, I think I got my copy for under $5. It was like in a 75% off bin. So, oh, you can't beat that. It's got Fantastic Four number 11 in it. So
hard to believe the Impossible Man wasn't a huge seller. It wasn't like a fan favorite, you know? Yeah, no, I like the story. I think it's really cute.
I think George Perez might have drawn an Impossible Man story or two, now that I think about it, from his run.
Oh, well, I guess it makes sense, because he drew Fantastic Four at one point, so
yep.
I guess that makes sense. There's a great little editor's note here on the page 2 of the story where the Impossible Man shows up, and somebody added a footnote where it's like, editor's note, by now you're probably thinking Stan and Jack have flipped their lids, but wait, things may get even wackier. It's like such a way for the editor to come in and be like, hey, everybody, calm down, it's fine, we'll be all right. And again, it's like, the idea that in 1962 you were referring to the creators of the comic by their first names, it's totally something unheard of in comics. I mean, DC wasn't even giving people credit in 1962, let alone making them sort of, you know, rock stars in the eyes of the kids reading the comics.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, especially paired with kind of the meta context of the next story that's also in the same issue, is this really was kind of a groundbreaking thing. And just kind of storytelling style.
Absolutely. Well, speaking of that, why don't you go right ahead and talk about a visit with the Fantastic Four?
Yes, so we have a visit with the Fantastic Four, same creative team, Stan Lee on script, art by Jack Kirby, Dick Ayers on inks. And this one made up the last half of the issue, and it's also reprinted here. So it opens on the street in New York, and the crowd is going nuts because the latest issue of Fantastic Four is for sale. And so crowds are rushing, fighting to get in line to pick up the latest issue. And then we see the Fantastic Four on their street clothes. Of course, Ben's got his purple trench coat and sunglasses and a big baggy hat cover up his face as they kind of stroll down the street. And they're just kind of amazed that people are going this nuts for him. And then there's a really neat moment where they walk up on the street and there's a bunch of kids pretending they're the Fantastic Four. So we see a kid with holding on to planks of wood with gloves on it, pretending he's Mr. Fantastic, stretching. There's a kid with sparklers jumping around in a red shirt, claiming he's the Human Torch. So a person in a bunch of clothes stuffed in a big baggy sweatshirt and then a thing mask. And then a little girl pretending she's hiding behind a pole that she's the Invisible Girl. So the Fantastic Four kind of meet them and engage with them and show them, well, this is how you really do it, and make the kids' day. And then they walk back to the Baxter Building where they meet Willie Lumpkin, who's complaining of his aching back because carrying their huge Santa-sized bag of feedback or fan mail, and complaining that he always has to carry that. So Ben Grimm shows him, well, it's not that heavy, and carries all the fan mail up to the top floor of the Baxter Building as they're going through it. And everybody has a little different treat here in the fan mail. Ben gets a prank from the Yancey Street Gang, the boxing glove on a spring that pounces him in the face when he opens it up. And Sue gets kind of some disappointing letters saying that she's not a very valued member of the team, and that kind of sets her back. And then the team kind of reflects while Johnny's, he says he's bored, he's getting a little sappy here. So the team kind of looks back and recaps their origin and kind of how they all met and got their powers. So nice little recap of the first issue of Fantastic Four 1 summarized here, as well as establishing kind of how Ben and Reed met in college and went on to fight during World War II. And we get some more Sue's not over name or thing. She's not sure if Reed's still the one. Kind of drama in there. And they're going through the fan mail, and Sue is naturally pretty depressed because people don't think she's a valuable member of the team. Ben is temporarily turned back to human by Reed's latest concoction, but that wears off. And so then they get this weird sound that they're hearing, this pinging from a rocket ship that they have sitting in a docking bay from their adventure on Planet X. And they go inside, and there's Johnny with a big happy birthday to Sue birthday cake surprise for her. That's really what he went off to do when he said it was getting too mushy. So they all have a nice big happy family moment and eat some birthday cake. So really neat little story. These are the type of stories that really kind of helped me fall in love with the Fantastic Four, is the family element. When I was recording with your partner in crime earlier this week and kind of talked about the Fantastic Four because I like to go on tangents. And I told him that I have Fantastic Four is right up there with Captain America, is kind of my favorite Marvel thing. And I view the whole team as kind of one character. I can't really pick out a favorite member of the team. You need all four of them for the dynamic to be right, because it's this great family atmosphere or environment. And that's really kind of what I cling to and what appeals to me the most. And so stories like this, where you really kind of flesh that out and see the give and take among the relationship between the four of them, are the perfect type of story for me. That's really what I come to the Fantastic Four.
Yeah, it's really cute. It's a really cute story, and I like, you know, Stan Lee is doing a little bit of you know, marketing here, because I mean you're trying to sell Fantastic Four to kids. So what better way than to show a crowd of people buying Fantastic Four comics? You know, it makes you want to get in on the excitement. You know, you're like, oh, look at all these other people are into it too. It's, you know, you should make sure you get every issue. And it's like, yeah, I should. That's an important. Look at all. I want to be part of the hip crowd and be this, you know. So it's like, it's a really cute story, and recapping the origin makes a lot of sense, you know, to throw that in. And I like Stan Lee addressing the whole issue of people saying that Sue Storm's not an equal member because she's a woman. I think that's way out of its time for 1962.
Yeah, definitely. And in some of the writer's defense, Stan did kind of write her as a wet blanket at this point. So some of the criticism that she wasn't holding her part of the team is not necessarily on her as a woman, maybe more on Stan's writing of her at the time,
right,
I think.
Right.
I think Sue really didn't come into her own consistently until the John Byrne run. I think he's really what made her into, in my eyes, the strongest member of the team. Just kind of, she was the glue that kind of held them together and helped them weather the storm through some pretty tough times. And that's really when...
weather the storm?
Yeah. Well, that run there is pretty heavy there than Byrne's run there on some of the things that their family goes through. But Sue's really kind of the... showed her on our raw power level as well to be one of the most powerful ones, you know, when she kind of turned the dark turn there.
Oh, yeah. You know. Burns FF run is amazing. Absolutely. It's might even say fantastic. Probably stop with those. But, you know, it's a really cute story. And it's probably a good pick for a Treasury edition, because it's just, you know, it's a nice palate cleanser, and it's a nice prep for what we're about to get into, which is super heavy.
Yeah.
Have a nice little family story of them just kind of being goofy and Willie Lumpkin with the whole fan mail. So
I love anytime they throw Willie Lumpkin in.
Yeah.
That to me, that is still my favorite of the Stan Lee cameos, is that first Fox Fantastic Four
right,
where he walks in as Willie the mailman. That will always be my favorite cameo.
It's cute. It's a really cute story. So, next up, there is a pinup, a two-page pinup by John Buscema and Frank Giacoya. I think that's how you say his name. And it's the Fantastic Four plus sort of assorted friends and family. We've got Alicia Masters. We've got Reed and Sue's kid, Medusa, Agatha Harkness, and Thundra. And then breaking into the background is Dr. Doom. And they're in front of a whole bunch of classic Kirby machinery. So it's a really nice photo. And again, Kyle, what you're talking about, you like the family element. This is, you know, the Fantastic Four family. It's a really yep. beautiful shot.
Yeah, this is great.
When are they going to put Thundra in one of the Marvel movies?
Yeah, I don't know. I would think maybe she'd show up on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. or something. I haven't really been watching that. That one's lost me. But
she's got a great visual. I love her costume, does. And I love that she's taller than the Thing. So she's probably like 7. We'll have to wait until they cover her on Ohatmu to find out exactly how tall she is. But she's this great Amazon-looking thing. It's a beautiful pinup. And, you know, we've learned over time, over the years, that John Buscema really didn't like superheroes. Like, that was not his forte. He really preferred Conan and adventure stories. But, man, for a guy who really didn't like what he was drawing, he certainly did it well enough. This is a beautiful drawing.
Yeah. He had a great stay on Fantastic Four. Yeah. He took over right after Kirby left and drew the tail end of the Stan Lee stories. From a story point, some of those stories kind of flounder, but man, the art is always gorgeous throughout those early 100s.
Yeah, it's a nice, again, it's a bonus feature, and I love that, I like that Marvel did that stuff. I mean, this is why I love the Treasuries, all the little bonus material that they would throw in when they had an extra page to fill here and there. It's just really, really cool stuff. So, the next story is part of a three-part, the Coming of Galactus story, which is about as big as it gets in terms of the Fantastic Four. So the first one is from Fantastic Four, number 48 from 1966, Lee and Kirby, of course, except this time the inker is Joe Sinnott. First story is The Coming of Galactus. The FF find themselves caught in the middle of a battle between Black Bolt and Maximus, two members of the Inhumans. It ends with the FF being forced out of a giant dome created by Maximus. As the FF at home, we head off into deep space where we meet a mysterious being named the Silver Surfer. The Surfer is looking for a planet, one rich in elemental resources. He turns towards Earth. Back on Earth, things have gone haywire. At one point, the sky fills with fire, yet it generates no heat. Mr. Fantastic is sure this means the planet is facing unimaginable danger, and he locks himself in his lab trying to determine what is happening. He becomes so single-minded he ignores the rest of the team, doesn't even eat or shave. When Sue finally gets in to see Reed, she sees standing there alongside him is Uatu, the Watcher, who is there to warn Reed about the danger approaching. The Surfer arrives, and after a brief battle with the Fantastic Four, his master finally appears, the giant being known as Galactus. Not to be terribly obvious, but for a Treasury, there cannot be a better villain than Galactus. No character is better suited to giant pages than the giant Galactus.
Agreed. Yeah, that big reveal there on the last page is awesome.
Yeah. I mean, he's literally...
two-thirds splash page.
Yeah. I mean, he is the size of, like, an action, you know, like a 12-inch doll, if you wanted to cut him out. He's that huge on the page.
Yeah, he's actually probably the exact same size back when Toy Biz had the Marvel Legends license in the kind of mid-2000s. They had a Galactus Build-A-Figure wave, and
that's
about how big he is. That exact size.
It's beautiful. This story also features a full-page illustration by Kirby where he started doing those collages, those photo collages, because there's this whole thing where the outside the Earth, all this Galactus machinery shows up, and it is just a photo collage. Kirby was doing these color-tinted photorealistic things, and it really gives the book, you know, it's very strange looking in the middle of all these pen and ink drawings to see these photorealistic things. And again, it fits really well at the giant size. It's nice to see them kind of printed so big.
Yeah.
When you think of like the Fantastic Four and the galaxy, you know, galaxy size scale of their stories that Kirby and Lee were doing, these are the stories you think about. These Galactus ones with the Silver Surfer. I mean, they're just impossibly huge. And so it's a perfect choice to run all three in this Treasury. I mean, it's like a mini trade paperback, you know, to run this collected story inside this one book. You know, I mean, it's what the Treasuries were doing early on, was collecting storylines. So this is a really, really fun first chapter.
Yeah, it definitely is. And it reads really well, too, since it's been kind of edited to get rid of some of the kind of recap and superfluous parts. So it flows really well. I would have picked up this Treasury right around the time that the 90s Fantastic Four cartoon was on TV, which I've heard some people aren't real fond of, but I love that thing. And they did a pretty decent job of covering this story arc in that cartoon as well. And
so really?
I'm not sure. It would have been right around the time I picked this up. I'm not sure what was my first exposure, if it was the cartoon or this kind of edited version of it. But the last way I would have actually read it would have been the issues in their, you know, original full length. And so that seems a little clunky to me compared to how it is here.
Yes, it's very streamlined. It's funny, speaking of like the FF and other media, like, I don't know what your feelings are about those first two Fantastic Four movies, but like when they did the second one and they turned Galactus into just a giant purple cloud, I remember at the time people were like, well, what are you going to do? You know, you literally couldn't do Galactus because people would just laugh. And I think nowadays, if Marvel did a Fantastic Four movie, they would just do Galactus. They would,
yeah.
They could pull it off. They're like, we've done a talking tree at this point. We've done a raccoon that shoots a gun. We can do Galactus. He doesn't need to be a giant purple cloud. We just have a guy with a giant, you know, antenna on the side of his head and a big G on his chest. We'll do it.
Yeah, I actually really enjoyed. I find a lot of fun and enjoyment out of those first two Fantastic Four movies. I will not talk about their latest abomination, but
no pun intended. Again,
yeah. But the what made it for me, I knew they probably couldn't pull off Galactus without it looking like the awful hell scenes in the Spawn movie, because I mean those are laughable, and that's really kind of the risk you're in if they would have tried to pull it off, was when they first showed the galactic storm cloud kind of moving through our solar system, when his kind of passed in front of Saturn, the shadow silhouette imprinted on the planet in the back was in the shape of his head. So it's
really?
Like oh well, at least yeah it's the shape of like his helmet. Yeah, so
oh.
I was like, oh, well, that made me happy at least. But the Fantastic Four cartoon came out on DVD like the week before the movie, the first movie hit theaters. And I actually had one of many shoulder surgeries that week. And so coming home from the, I hit up the comic book shop on the way to my surgery. So I'm sitting there reading comics before surgery prep. And then I convinced my parents to stop at Walmart, driving me back from surgery because it would have been high school at the time, or just out of high school.
How can they say no to you when you're coming back from surgery?
Yeah, exactly. I'm all drugged up. I was like, I want to pick out some movies. And I go to the DVD aisle at Walmart, and there they had the complete cartoon on DVD. I was like, yes, we're getting this. And so while I laid in bed recovering from shoulder surgery for the next 2 weeks, I just watched those cartoons over and over again. And I convinced them then to take me to the movie the next night is when the first one opened in theaters, and I was pretty drugged up at the time from pain pills, but I had a blast there.
I can imagine your like drug-filled review. It's like Kyle Benning gives this movie 5 thumbs up. And you're like, what? Okay, good. Yeah. And
yeah.
I also like the giant spiders that were on the ceiling of the theater. That was great, too. I was like, okay, thanks. All right, Kyle, please. All right. Just
yeah.
So why don't you move on? Let's go move on. Move on to Fantastic Four number 49, If This Be Doomsday.
All right. We resume the action with Galactus and the Watcher debating face-to-face on the rooftop of the Baxter Building. Ben quickly grows tired of all the talking, decides that it's time for action, and he tries to punch Galactus in the ankle and is quickly dismissed like an insect. The hot-headed Human Torch attempts to take down Galactus and is equally ineffective. Meanwhile, across town, the Silver Surfer tumbles through the skylight of Alicia Masters' apartment. As Alicia teaches the Silver Surfer about humanity, Galactus sets to assembling his elemental converter device for stripping Earth of its life essence. The Watcher reappears before the Fantastic Four and tells them of his plan. A lone device can stop the Devourer of Worlds, and the Human Torch is the only one that can get it. Johnny flies through time and space, crossing lengths undescribable, while Ben, Reed, and Sue attempt to delay Galactus as much as possible. But their interference is only temporary. It seems time has run out. As the Silver Surfer enters the fray, it appears that Earth's total destruction is at hand.
I love the splash page, the four Fantastic Four staring off at the screen, like that's amazing. And then the following page where they look like ants compared to Galactus and Uatu standing there talking, like it's just the scale of it is just so perfect. And you know, it's perfect in the regular comic and then perfect as a treasury, just looking at these giant characters looming over our main heroes. It's such a really great moment.
Yes, it is. Yeah. Reed is always, in this one, he looks so disheveled because he hasn't shaved, as you mentioned in the first chapter there. But his beard there is pretty patchy and weak. growing up, whenever we saw someone with weak facial hair like that, my dad described it as a Klingon beard. So that's all I can think of when I see that.
Interesting. Now, it's funny, when Reed takes time to shave it off, he and Ben use the bathroom at the same time. So poor, you know, Reed's in the mirror shaving while the thing is getting a bath. Like, don't they have more than one bathroom in the Baxter building? Do they really need to double up in the bathroom? I mean, this, you know, come on, guys. You couldn't put two bathrooms in the Baxter building?
I don't know. Maybe it's more like a team locker room thing, because Johnny's standing in there looking all burnt and stuff, too. So,
Or maybe Sue has her own bathroom, probably.
Yep. Maybe that's where they go and have their locker room talk.
Yeah. Oh, God. let's not even talk about that. And then all the stuff with the Fantastic, all the stuff with Silver Surfer is great. I love the little monster that Galactus 6 on the Fantastic Four, and he's called the Punisher. I think that's a great little bit. Of course, they would go back to use that name later on. And then the machinery that Johnny has to go search out in the other dimension, that is such classic Kirby machinery.
Yes, it's just gorgeous in this huge format.
Oh, it's just, like, just, again, the visual imagination you have to come up with that. Because it looks like an M.C. Escher painting, because all the machinery turns in and on itself, and there's all these other doohickeys sticking out, and it's just, you know, it's like you just see that Kirby's imagination was just spilling off these pages. I mean, he just couldn't contain himself. There's just so much going on in any given panel.
Yeah, it's great, and it's colored really well and everything, and that scene, like you said, where he's flying towards the machinery, I mean, that's just kind of, when I think of Marvel Cosmic Image, just that space scene is the type of stuff that comes to mind. There you get kind of like a supernova, Kirby crackle in the background, and different galaxies and planets. It's amazing.
Yeah, and you know, and other times Kirby, of course, I mean, God, I don't need to compliment Jack Kirby. Everyone knows how good Jack Kirby is. But, you know, it wasn't all just detail, because there's another panel on that same page where Johnny is flying through kind of like a dimensional vortex. And the way Kirby represented that is just these little blue squiggly shapes. So it looks like a road map almost, except it's just these blue lines on a black background. It's very simple and very beautiful, you know? So, I mean, it wasn't always that he, you know, of course, you know, two panels later, he's up to the machinery, which is detailed as all get out. But I liked it when Kirby did it simple, too. I mean, that's a really great visual of showing us that Johnny is somewhere that our imagination really can't quite capture, because it doesn't look like anything we're familiar with. It's a great, these stories are great. And I love the design of the Punisher, this little gnome type guy with his three toed feet. And he's got the kind of the bug head machinery. I love that little character. He's just sort of tossed off. It's very quickly, he's dispatched, the FF deal with him, and then we never really see him again. But again, it's just this little side guy, and Kirby gives him such character.
Yeah, he's a really neat design. I see the aesthetic of that used a lot more in a lot of his later work, like stuff in the 80s. He was doing like Captain Victory.
Yes, yep.
And Silver Star. And then some of his design images, which would be adapted by other people later in the 90s and stuff. You see a lot more of kind of that raw, mysterious space man, insect type thing, aesthetic all tapped up in there. It's really neat. Because otherwise, I mean, the characters here are much more streamlined compared to, you know, more of his 70s stylized stuff. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of neat to see him at the top of his game, and not as stylized in most of the other figures here, but then that just reeks of his 80s stylized stuff. So it's kind of hidden in there. It's neat.
Yeah. I also love, as a story moment, the thing that eventually, no pun intended, the thing that makes the Punisher finally give up is when Sue puts the team in one of her invisible bubbles. And the Punisher can't penetrate it. So he's out there pounding at it, and he just gives up. Eventually, Galactus is like, enough, loyal one. Back to your ship now. You have served your purpose. So I love that it's Sue is the one that finally kind of gives the Punisher to give up. I think that's a great detail, great moment for her.
Yes, it is. Yep.
So the final story is this third chapter of this amazing sequence. It's Fantastic Four number 50. Once again, Lee and Kirby and Joe Sinnott. The startling saga of the Silver Surfer. The Surfer returns to Earth and fights Galactus. Meanwhile, Johnny returns from his other dimensional trip with the needed piece of hardware. Reed uses it against Galactus, and it slows him down momentarily. Uatu talks to Galactus and convinces him to leave Earth alone, but not before he turns his wrath towards his former herald. Galactus takes away the Surfer's galaxy-roaming powers, leaving him behind on Earth after Galactus disappears. Alicia Masters talks with the Surfer, leaving the Thing to stew with jealousy. The Surfer takes off, looking to explore Earth. Alicia turns to Ben, but he has left. Now, that's not where this comic book ends. The original comic has a whole other subplot going on, which is, again, very strange pacing for Stan Lee to end the story basically midway through the comic and then pick up the threads of another story. Now, that's not reprinted here in The Treasury. In The Treasury, the story ends with Alicia looking for Ben, because that's sort of the moment where this Galactus story ends. So that's the final moment, again, in the Treasury. If you have any of the original comics, you'll see that the story goes on, and Johnny goes to college, and he meets Wyatt Wingfoot, and there's all this stuff with Ben wandering the streets of New York. But the Treasury ends with Alicia saying goodbye to the Silver Surfer. So, you know, it's an amazing finale. The shot of Galactus as he disappears and he's surrounded in sort of those flames and he's like half obscured by them. That's such a, and he gives the FF a warning. The game has ended. The prize has eluded me. And at last I perceive the glint of glory within the race of man. It's, you know, a great Galactus panel. Might be one of the best ever of the character.
Yeah, definitely. He's shrouded in that kind of red flame and Kirby crack, like you said. And that's classic, Marvel Comics there.
This is one of the great FF stories, and you know, it made perfect Treasury fodder to give those two stories, which are kind of intros to the characters, and that you got Dr. Doom in some manner, but then you're getting to the later on stuff where they really became something that nobody had ever done in comics before. And so it's really fun to see these three stories, even though they're edited slightly for the Treasury. I think it's great to see them all together like this. And as you mentioned, it's really streamlined because all the, you know, subplots are taken out. So the thing moves at a lightning pace.
Yeah, this story continues to live up to the hype. I mean, that's one of the seminal runs in Marvel's history. And to see it in this giant format and just take in the art and all its glory is the best way to read it, is often the case with, when it comes to treasuries, that's the best format you'll ever get to read the story in.
Absolutely. So the final little piece of fun that we have in this edition is on the inside back cover. There's a reprint of the inside the Baxter Building schematic. It was originally run in Fantastic Four Annual number 3. Here it's in black and white, and we get cutaways of all the stuff in the Baxter Building. And we see Reed and Ben, our permanent residents. Reed has an apartment, Ben has an apartment. There's an asbestos room for the Human Torch. That doesn't seem terribly safe. There's a reception room, a dining room, a gymnasium. It's, you know, it's a great drawing, and it's super fun, and it's a darn shame that Mego never got around to making a Baxter Building playset. Because this, you know, they did a Wayne Foundation, they did a Batcave, they did a Fortress of Solitude. A Baxter Building playset would have been killer.
Yeah, that would have been awesome.
It's a great, I love all these little details. I mean, again, this was originally done in the Fantastic Four Annual. It wasn't done for this Treasury, but I love that they reprinted it here. It's, you know, especially since the first story is so significantly taking place on the Baxter Building, all about the Baxter Building. It's great to have this little schematic. And you know, again, this was something that Stan Lee did. It mentions here the Baxter Building. Just east of Fifth Avenue in Midtown Manhattan stands the Baxter Building. You know, again, I love the DC fake cities, Metropolis, Gotham, you know, Midway, whatever, Central. But it was something, it was really cool. It really fired up my imagination when I was a kid to think that the Baxter Building had an address.
Yeah.
That literally existed. Because Fifth Avenue is a real place. So as a kid, you're like, ooh, I could go to New York and look at the Baxter Building. Wouldn't that be exciting?
Yeah, and I think DC realized that too, because they started to add in real cities post-crisis, especially in JLI. Something came up in an episode just recorded with Shag, is they specifically call out, in New York City. It's like, oh, wow, that's just weird to read in a DC comic.
Yeah. It's cool. It's great. I mean, I would imagine that the, you know, having the rent to be around the Baxter Building was probably pretty low, because the danger of your building being destroyed by Skrulls or, you know, Paste Pot Pete or something.
Explored.
Was it really?
Yeah. It was in the late 90s, and I cannot remember if it was during the Wade Waringo run or if it was done right before that, when like Jeff Loeb and Chris Backlow were working on it. That might have came from their run.
So they talked about they talked about what it was like to live around the Baxter Building.
Yeah, the kind of people complaining about property values and how they're tired of their stuff always getting destroyed, and they brought in damage control, right?
That was the group.
And so that was another one. Is I always had a fondness for the damage control, because I there's two or three minis the early 90s, but I managed to get all those courtesy of like the comics repacks and stuff I pick up.
the lovely grocery
stores
packs
and stuff when I was little, and so I always had a fascination for damage control, and a lot of those had to like Ernie Chan covers, which I know you're a big fan of, and so it was fun to see them. I'd only ever seen them in those three or four Marvel miniseries, and then they were pulled into the 90s run of the Fantastic Four then as well. So in that story where they're kind of talking about that, but,
always wondered
around
how
that same time too, and I think this one I think for sure was in the Wade Waringo run, was it came out that all the Yancey Street pranks, like the boxing glove to the face that we saw earlier, mm-hmm. the mail issue, that was really Johnny secretly behind that the whole time.
I have to wonder how Reed could get insurance for the Baxter Building. I mean, my dad worked in insurance his whole life, so I probably know a little more about insurance than the average person, but there's just no way you're paying the premiums for getting insurance to the Baxter Building. It's a giant magnet for aliens to attack, or supervillains. I mean, good Lord, they're only six issues into the FF's career, and the building's already been sent into outer space. I mean, you can't... there's no way you're paying for that. But, that's... I'll have to maybe track those stories in. That sounds like it's a lot of fun. So
that was a frequent subplot of the cartoon as well. The landlord was always getting on him about how it was hurting the property values and wrecking your building, and always screaming at him. And stuff,
that's great. Oh, that's really fun. So the final thing is the back cover, and it's by, again, John Buscema, and it's just a really beautiful drawing of the Fantastic Four looking off into space, looking like astronauts, which, of course, they were. So it's, and you've got kind of the ink lines coming at them, which sort of vaguely feels like cosmic rays, which it mentions there on the copy. So, it's just a really nice, iconic image of the Fantastic Four.
Yeah, this all around, it's a gorgeous, gorgeous issue. And it's hard for me to think about it real critically because it was my introduction to the Treasury format and featured my favorite of Marvel. So I picked some fantastic stories on top of that. So it's pretty much perfect in my eyes.
Great way to start. Great way to start an introduction to Treasuries and introduction to these characters. You can't beat it. It's a great, great comic. So it's Marvel Treasury number two. Number one is a great comic. We'll profile that at some point. But number two, they were really, they had two in a row. They did a great, they really knew how to present the best of their characters in this format. So
did you pick this one up when you were a kid? I remember we went into that. You asked me, and I don't remember if you said.
No, I can't remember getting it, but I bought so many of the Marvel Treasuries, I'm pretty sure I had this one. Although maybe I got it later on, because I would have been would have been a toddler when this came out, so I wouldn't have been old enough. So maybe a lot of these Treasuries stayed on newsstands for a while or at department stores. Like it wasn't like regular size comics, which after a month got pulled. These actually stayed on sale for a while. So maybe I got it later on, or like not a used bookstore, but maybe in some other, second run place. Because I remember having a lot of these that I could not have had when they first came out, but I had them a couple of years later as a slightly older kid.
Did you ever take advantage of any of those house ads that make me drool 40 years later? Of you could send in for back issues of the Treasury comics for super cheap.
I did not. I did. I don't know why I did. Maybe because I think I was just probably too shy to ask my parents for money. I know I have the reputation of Moneybags Kelly, but I really was not going around asking my parents for too much more. They tended to buy me comics off the stands, but I don't remember mailing in for a lot of things, even though I certainly wanted to. Because those ads were so beautiful. And again, it was something that the Treasuries were different than regular comics. Was that you could buy back issues from the publisher. You were always seeing in letters pages where they were talking about, we don't stock old issues of our magazines, except for the Treasuries. They did that. You could go and buy these from Marvel or DC later on, because these books were sort of meant to be a little more permanent, despite, sometimes it's hard to store them because of their size. They were square bound. The Marvel Treasuries, unlike the limited collector's editions, were square bound. So they were meant to be a little more bookish, a little more permanent. So I know I must have had this one as a kid because I've always been familiar with it. So it's a great book. It's a classic Treasury edition. So, Kyle, thank you so much for coming on to talk about it, man. I really had a lot of fun, and I'm glad that you were – when I talked to you about being on the show, you were, named this one really early on.
Yeah, no, thank you for having me. I'm obviously a big fan of the format and love your show, just like every show on the Fire & Water Network. So I'm always happy when I can make a guest appearance on one of the shows here.
Well, thank you very much. So once again, remind everybody where, I know you said your shows are on hiatus, but until they come back, where can people go and find them?
You can look on iTunes for the time being at for King Size Comics Giant Size Fun, or you can go to kingsizecomicsgiantsizefun.blogspot.com, or I'm also on Facebook, and I have links to all the shows there, so you can download them directly or go through iTunes.
Very
cool. It's Jack Kirby's 100th birthday this year, and so I was hoping to knock out a lot of Jack Kirby coverage once I kind of feel like getting back behind the mic, or I guess behind the wheel of my car, and go to lunch on.
And who knows, maybe we'll even do another Jack Kirby Treasury for his 100th birthday year.
That would be great.
Before we sign off, Kyle, I need to ask you what I ask any of the guests who have some familiarity with the treasuries growing up. The two questions is, first off, what treasury would you like to have seen DC or Marvel do that you think they should have done? Again, Wonder Woman is off the table because Wonder Woman is the obvious answer. And then the other question is, what treasury would you like to have seen Marvel do, or DC, or anybody really, that you personally would like to have seen? Forget about any sales considerations. Just what treasury would you, Kyle Benning, would have really killed to have as a kid? So what are your answers?
All right. So every time you ask this, I'm like outside or driving or whatever, and I always shake my head and very much agreement with whatever your guests say. But then I always think of like 15 other ones. So one of your guests, I think it was during one of the Batman episodes, mentioned a Brave and the Bold treasury.
That's
a no-brainer. That would have been great to see Aparo art huge like that. And so kind of taking a step out of that, I would have really liked to seen a treasury of the Jim Aparo, Michael Fleischer, Spectre run that ran through Adventure Comics. Some of those images at this size of format would have been just absolutely amazing.
Great answer. I never thought that would have been.
And then kind of on the Marvel side of that, I would have liked to seen the, it was like a 3 or 4 issue run by Jim Steranko on Captain America done in the Treasury edition.
That too. Good answers. Those are both really, Steranko, that Steranko stuff would have been amazing. Oh boy, those would have been. Oh, boy. Kyle, that's great. But he really had time to think about things. Those are both terrific answers. I mean, I think a Spectre treasury would have just damaged kids' psyches at that age, watching, you know, guys get turned into, you know.
They did a couple of House of Mystery ones, so.
They did. Ooh, that's amazing.
That would have been amazing. But as far as, regardless of sales, what I would have liked to see, I have 3 of them here. A one-off, self-contained new JSA story written and drawn by Jerry Ordway at the height of his career.
Jeez. Oh, my God. Why don't you ask for anything else?
Yeah. And then the other two would have been similar in that vein. John Byrne on whatever he wanted to write and draw, made specifically for this format at the peak of his career in the mid-80s. And then a George Perez Avengers story, original story made for Treasury Edition in the mid-80s.
Oh, boy. Yeah, the mind reeled at all those. Just, you know, like, if they had ever actually pulled off that JLA Avengers thing that Perez was going to draw and done it as a treasury, oh, that would have been so cool. Those are all great answers. Yeah, Burn at the treasury size really would have worked well, especially, like, even a collection of his Fantastic Four stuff would have been really cool. Like, the Ego the Living Planet storyline that he did, all that. Oh, man, all that stuff would have been great.
Or his Marvel 2-in-1 number 50, where he had the Thing go back in time and fight the early days, kind of more muck monster Thing that we saw in the early Kirby issues. That's
wow.
One of my favorite stories. I think that was the first time he ever wrote the Fantastic Four. That was shortly before he took over as the writer of the main series.
Oh, wow. I don't think I knew that. Oh, that's cool.
So that's one of my all-time favorite issues. Love that one.
All right. Yeah, those are all great answers. Terrific. You've said you've had a lot of time in your car to think about these.
Yes. Well, and you always mention the great idea is, why isn't someone throwing together Treasury editions to tie into movies and stuff? And so I'm hoping that somebody at Warner Brothers will be listening to this suggestion that I've even seen you throw out at Twitter, Adam, and stuff, and that they finally get around to making a Captain Marvel movie that they call Shazam. That hopefully the template for that movie is Jerry Ordway's Power of Shazam graphic novel, and then to coincide with it, they just decide to take that graphic novel and reprint it at treasury size and throw that in a toy aisle at Walmart. And just be so much win across the board. It would be perfect.
We can dream. We can dream. Yeah. All good answers, man. Terrific. That's fantastic. Yeah. Oh, the Spectre one. Oh, boy. Just seeing that guy turned into a block of wood and then shaved into slices at a giant size. Oh, Oh, that's so cool. So, terrific answers, Kyle. Again, thank you so much for coming on the show. I really appreciate it. Everybody, check out King Size Comic Giant Size Fun, and hopefully it'll be back soon. And in the meantime, listen to these podcast promos. And when we come back, we were going to do listener feedback.
The Fantasticast is your guide to the Fantastic Four from the beginning of the Marvel Age of Comics in 1961 onwards.
Each week, Steve Lacy and Andy Leyland cover every issue, spin-off, guest appearance and cameo, and more.
And in 2015, we begin our journey through the decade that Taste forgot, the 1970s.
Join us as we take a look at
the departure of Jack Kirby and Stan Lee,
the Kree-Skrull War,
the arrival of Marvel Team-Up,
Bill Murray as the Human Torch,
creators including Roy Thomas, George Perez, Marv Wolfman, Jerry Conway, Rich Buckler and John Byrne,
and of course, Marvel 2-in-1.
All this and more at ffcast.libsyn.com and on iTunes and Stitcher.
The Fantastic Cast.
Insert catchy tagline here. Wait, what?
Hi, I'm Kyle Binning, and I love comics. In fact, I love them so much that I ramble on about them on a number of podcasts, all on one feed, found under the King Size Comics Giant Size Fun banner. I talk about comics with extra page counts, like Treasury Comics, Prestige Format Books, DC's Dollar Comics, Marvel's Giant Size Specials and King Size Annuals, and much, much more. I also love to talk about DC's Crisis on Multiple Earth crossovers, free comics from special promos, free comic book day, Star Wars, my life as a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles fan, random comic book back issues, and many other elements of geek culture that happen to strike my fancy. There's new content usually dropping at least once a week, and it's all found on one feed. You can subscribe via iTunes, just search for King Size Comics Giant Size Fun in the iTunes Store or podcast app on your iPhone. Otherwise, you can follow the podcast at the King Size Comics Giant Size Fun blog headquarters, available at www.kingsizecomicsgiantsizefun.blogspot.com. That's all one word, kingsizecomicsgiantsizefun.blogspot.com. Or follow on Facebook by simply searching for King Size Comics Giant Size Fun. So for snappy review and discussions on comics, new and old, usually done from the front seat of my car or my lunch break at work, check out King Size Comics Giant Size Fun.
And we're back with listener feedback, and this is listener feedback for episode 9, which was the King Kong Treasury with Dr. Ange. We didn't get any iTunes reviews again, so we're going to move right on to the comments on our network page, which is fireandwaterpodcast.com. First up, Nicholas Prom. He says, still listening to this episode as I write this, but a couple of notes about the art. George Wilson was the artist on many, if not most or all, of Gold Key's painted covers. Giovanni Ticci and Alberto Giolitti were best known as the art team on Turok, Son of Stone. Interestingly, the two artists drew Turok and Andar in their own likenesses. I didn't know any of that, Nicholas. Thank you very much for the info. I should have looked all that stuff up before I recorded, but I'm lazy sometimes. So thank you very much. And if you guys want to follow Nicholas, he does his own podcast, which is called Comic Reflections. And he appeared on episode 84 of my Film and Water podcast talking about the original King Kong movie. Thank you, Nicholas. Ryan Daly from our network says, nothing to add about the King Kong comic or the Treasury Edition, but since you brought up the Peter Jackson remake, I have a thought on that film. My memory is that Jackson's version of King Kong was fine, maybe even great, but too long. More than that, though, I knew when I left the theater I never wanted to see the movie again. Why such a strong reaction to a film I didn't dislike? Because of the insect pit scene. And then Ryan goes into the grisly details of the insect pit scene. And then he follows up with, again, I'm not someone easily grossed out, but after that scene, I had to retreat to a very quiet place in my mind, and I don't really remember anything that happened later in the movie. That can happen sometimes, Ryan. Thank you for the comment. Martin Gray from the Too Dangerous for a Girl blog says, lovely episode as ever. Great story from Ange about his mom. I never saw the 1976 King Kong, though I did enjoy the Mad Magazine spoof. I really liked the Peter Jackson version. I love the island scenes and the realization of 30s New York. I'll likely go to Skull Island, as twere, though Samuel L. Jackson puts me off. I just wish he'd try playing a part as something other than cool Samuel L. Jackson. I suspect Ange learned Voluminous from Volstagg in Thor. Superman taught me invulnerable, ironic, and of course, chronosynclastic infundibulum. I can't even pronounce that word at all, Martin. You'll have to give me a pronunciation guide for that. Anyway, thank you very much. Chris Franklin from our network, Supermates Podcast and the Power Records Podcast says, great episode. Count me in as someone who likes to impress their folks and anyone who would listen with comic learned adjectives. I ate just about every elementary school vocab test thanks to comics. I wasn't aware of this treasury existed until I saw it on the blog. I agree there should be a Kong Skull Island treasury out now. Get on it, Hollywood. And he says, always a pleasure to hear Dr. Ange. Yes, it always is a pleasure to hear Dr. Ange. Thank you, Chris. And finally, also from our network, Siskoid, he says, oh yeah, there's some classic Gold Key art. Looks just like their Star Trek comics of the era. That Blue Kong, I can't help but see him as Marvel's Beast. Just me? Okay. Great episode as always. We won't be happy until you do a Kong episode for every show you host, Rob. As I mentioned to Siskoid in the comments, there is a Bob Dylan song where he mentions King Kong, so you never know. Anyway, thanks everybody for the comments. As always, you can leave more comments on our site, which is fireandwaterpodcast.com. And now we're going to move on to Twitter, where these are people who gave us retweets or likes. I appreciate very much. RTaylor32, Old Spine, Kaz, KXZ, I don't know. Classic JLA, Trekker Talk, Peter War 4, TXEO NPBDL 4YYB56. Okay. Lucy Desire, Plaid Stallions, Germ Trinity, Chuck Rod 75, Bazinga Cal, The Baslevic, Comic Reflection, Siskoid, Martin Gray, Dr. Ann 70, Comics Corner Pod, Coffee Comics Blog, Studio Stella, False Lie Studios, J3KC, Longbox Crusade, Hey J. Krenz 2, Maxo Romero, Mercurial Public 1, Abel Padzilla, Monkey Butt Chew, that's fun to say, E-Supertrain 1, Bri underscore Reno, Koi Avenger, Walters, Waters Rob, Kimmature, Logan Emok, Gen 64 Sen, Vintage Toy Ad, and Radio Invaders. Thank you everybody for the retweets and likes, very much appreciated. And before I send off, there's two other things I just want to mention briefly as sort of a thanks. First of all, I have to thank my pals Martin Gray and Greg Arujo, who provided me with some scans of some classic Treasury ads. I have most of the DC ads, I think, that they've done at this point for their Treasury comics, that they ran in comics at the time. But the Marvel ones are particularly hard to find. I don't know why, but they are. I seem to find the same kind of Treasury ads over and over again, but I know that Marvel must have advertised them. So both Greg and Martin found ads, one for a Buck Rogers comic and another for a Tarzan comic. And they scanned them in for me, and I got to put them on the Twitter feed, which is, of course, at Treasury Comics on Twitter. So thanks very much. Anybody who finds me a Treasury ad and sends it in, you will get thanked here on the podcast, because I really appreciate finding those ads. Those are super cool. So thanks, guys, for those ads. And finally, related to the King Kong episode, right after it posted, I got a comment on the Facebook page from a Jeff Shanks, and he apparently bought on eBay a King Kong display box along with 24 mint copies of the King Kong Treasury. It was sold as a set, like a shrink wrap set. And I never knew this existed. Now, I had known that DC had done some display boxes for their treasuries, also known in the industry, unflatteringly, as dumps. And you see them in bookstores, and you used to see them in record stores when those things existed. Just those cardboard displays. And so I know DC did them. I never knew that they did one for King Kong, but there was somebody selling it on eBay, and it's a big, bright, boldly colored box, and it says King Kong on the side, and then there's like a little tray for all the copies. So those must have been sent to department stores. I know that, you know, we talked about that Whitman put their label on this King Kong treasury, and Whitman sold their comics in department stores, not newsstands and stuff, so that must have been what it was for. I have never had any idea that it existed, and even if I had, I wouldn't have thought that anyone would still have them. So he owns it, and he was nice enough to allow me to post the picture again on the Twitter feed so everybody could see it. It's a really great find. I love seeing stuff like that. And as I've said many times before, I'm really not going to rest until I find one of those DC display boxes. I refuse to believe that they aren't still out there in some capacity. You can see some pictures of them over on my site, treasurycomics.com. There was a shot of them in an issue of Amazing World of DC Comics, and then there was another photo, I think it's DC President Sal Harrison, and sitting in the background, you can see the display, and there's some Superman comics in there. So DC did do some merchandising displays, so I'm really hoping they are still out there, because good Lord, if that King Kong Treasury box is still out there, I have to think that some DC ones are too. So I would love to own those. My collecting days are generally over, but if I ever saw that on eBay and I could afford it, I wouldn't be able to pass that up. So thanks so much to Jeff for that for that picture. That was just tremendous. What a find. So, again, thanks, everybody, for listening. Thanks so much to Kyle Benning for coming on to talk about the Fantastic Four Treasury. That was super fun. As always, you can find the show over on our network site, which is fireandwaterpodcast.com. And our Twitter feed is, of course, at Treasury Comics. So thanks, everybody, for listening. And until the next episode, go big or go home.